Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a book you can smell. And in just a moment, we'll talk to a Northern Arizona farmer about the agricultural impact of federal funding cuts. But first, it has already been a tumultuous year at the Washington Post. A few weeks ago, a memo leaked about the future of the paper's editorial page. The memo, written by Washington Post owner and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, announced that any editorials that were not, quote, of America and for America would no longer be welcome at the Post. Shortly afterward, longtime Post editorial columnist Ruth Marcus quit the paper, claiming one of her columns had been spiked because it was critical of Bezos' memo. All of this came alongside the paper's announcement that it would be making major changes to the newsroom with the goal of prioritizing, quote, growing digital products. As one member of the paper's leadership put it, text will no longer be a default format. In the midst of all this, the Post has also brought on a new managing editor who just so happens to be an Arizonan. Peter Spiegel joins the Post after a long career as a political reporter, foreign correspondent, and bureau chief at places like Forbes, the Financial Times, and the Wall Street Journal. I caught up with him recently about his journalistic origin story, which began right here in Phoenix.
I was in Scottsdale Public Schools, and I remember very distinctly, like maybe like every other journalist, there was just one teacher in sixth grade at Hopi Elementary, Mrs. Pitts, and she did this thing where she had us make our own newspapers. It was, gosh, I even remember the lead story was about Jimmy Carter and Leonid Brezhnev. That's how far back it was.
Okay.
But we literally were cutting, we drew, you know, with crayons pictures, and we wrote them out in longhand, and we cut and pasted them onto newspaper. And I just thought it was the coolest thing that I could, as a kid, or even as just someone living in Phoenix, write about events that were global and international. And that just got me hooked. And frankly, Ms. Pitts, if you're listening, thank you very much. You got me hooked into journalism.
Yeah, shout out to Ms. Pitts. I love it. What do you think it was about the experience? Was it the fact that you could make your own kind of media product that contained information? Do you remember having any tangible feeling about that?
We were the kind of family that at home over dinner, my parents would talk about current events. My dad was a big Barry Goldwater supporter. Goldwater was actually at the time still in the Senate. Barry Goldwater's grandson was actually on my brother's soccer team. And so we would see him occasionally at soccer practice and soccer games and stuff like that. And, you know, not that Phoenix back then was in any way a backwater, but
sure,
it was still a relatively small town. And for, you know, I still remember as a kid, if I wanted to listen to a baseball game, I would get Vin Scully and I'd get the Dodgers because there was no hometown team at the time. And
right.
So it felt a little bit like this is a window into a larger world that I didn't otherwise have.
Yeah. Well, and if I'm hearing you right, Peter, if I may, there's also a little hint in there of Goldwater not just being a name that has a political resonance to it, but also being a guy at a soccer practice. Like there was a little bit of a humanization element to your
100%.
Kind of context.
And I guess that, you know, the two things are connected, right? Like, you know, growing up in Phoenix, sometimes you felt very disconnected from global events, but you had it at the dinner table, and then you were introduced to a guy that I later learned was a national figure, ran for president. Oh,
right.
Hey, there's this grandkid. I mean, it was making what was global very, very real to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, if I may, I actually want to jump quite a bit ahead in your story now, because I know, if I'm not mistaken, you worked overseas for a time, right? When you were at the Financial Times in Brussels and London?
Yeah, for about 10 years. So, you know, again, part of that spark was I've always been interested in international affairs. And
yeah,
I had, you know, a couple of tours of duty in London because I worked for the Financial Times, which is a London-based news organization, but then was Brussels bureau chief for about 6 years. And it really was, in many ways, a dream come true.
Yeah. I mean, that's really lovely. I am, admittedly, though, also kind of curious about this from a wonkier standpoint, which is that, if I'm not mistaken, the years that you were abroad is, roughly speaking, like 2010 to 2019. And that is a period of time when there were just all of these seismic transformations in how news was delivered and consumed, not to mention pretty seismic times in American politics. And so when you came back, I'm wondering what you made of both the media landscape and the news landscape here. Did it feel like a giant shift?
Yeah, it really did. I mean, to be perfectly blunt, a figure like Donald Trump, if you had told me that he would be elected president, even a couple of years before I left, I would have said, no. That kind of populist, nationalist kind of sentiment, we saw that with Pat Buchanan running against, in the Republican primary against George H.W. Bush. It always gets 20, 25% of the Republican vote. It never achieves national prominence. And boom, I come home and Donald Trump is president. But as you said, also the media landscape, here in Washington, I had left and you had even medium-sized papers like the Baltimore Sun, even the Arizona Republic had small to medium-sized Washington bureaus, and they were all gone. And in its place were things that were digital only. Politico had obviously started and was ramping up, Axios, and trying to figure out how legacy media, for lack of a better word, fit in that is much more what I do now in this new job at the Post.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought up the Post and the idea of legacy papers, because in writing about you coming on board, the executive editor at the paper, Matt Murray, specifically cited how he is going to be looking to you to help shape the, quote, next chapter of the Post. What can you tell us about what that means to you?
Well, so much like the Post, the Financial Times had for 150 years been a print newspaper. The system by which we produced the news was very much reporters come in the morning, they work on their stories, they file in the afternoon, we put it in the newspaper in the evening, and then they go home. Problem with that is the digital audience. Readers do not show up in the evening. They show up in the morning. The Post still makes a decent amount of money off its print edition, but of the numbers keep moving over to close to 3 million subscribers to the Post, the percentage of them that are the print edition is almost de minimis. And trying to regularize our operations so we're focused on that morning reader, to own the morning on the politics story. Mm-hmm. How do we draw people to the site to read it through news alerts, through even TikTok and some of the social media? The Post has been a little bit behind on some of that stuff.
But do you view like TikTok or Instagram or newsletters or podcasts, whatever the case may be, do you view those things as distinct editorial products, or is the idea that those things will point readers / viewers, I guess, back to the core print version of the paper?
I think it's got to be both. I mean, the mantra, which I always say, which is frankly not original, not even mine, is we have to meet the readers where they are.
Sure. Well, speaking of readers, there's also been this ongoing controversy about the opinion pages at the Post. Mm-hmm. And after the letter was published from Jeff Bezos about his different vision for how he wants the opinions to be expressed, tens of thousands of digital subscribers canceled their subscriptions to the paper. How are you thinking about that? And more than that, I'm wondering, what in your mind is the role of a healthy opinion section?
It's a good question. I'm not sure I have a brilliant answer to it. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I keep saying is go to WashingtonPost.com and look at our journalism, not our opinion journalism, but our reporting. We are not pulling our punches. And as a matter of fact, we have had a really good run of scoops and exclusives on this administration. And that's just, the best way to counter that argument that somehow we are, a newfangled kind of news organization.
Well, can I ask you, we have heard about things like at the LA Times, for example, where the owner of that paper has talked about putting a fairness meter on the regular journalism, not the opinion pages. Have you gotten any indication that Jeff Bezos is concerned about what happens outside of the opinion pages?
There is no evidence that I have seen that Jeff Bezos wants to get involved in that kind of stuff. Let me give you a different example, because I used to work for the Wall Street Journal for a time, and Rupert Murdoch owns the Wall Street Journal. And Rupert Murdoch is not a shy and retiring person when it comes to his views on politics. And the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal is not shy or retiring about their views. They've always been a very right-wing opinion pages. But if you go to the news pages of the Wall Street Journal, they do amazing journalism. They were the ones who broke Stormy Daniels. So I guess my argument there would be there are numerous examples of news organizations where the opinion pages, which are run by the publisher and the owner, are firewalled from the news pages, and the news pages do amazing work without fear or favor. And I think, the LA Times, being an LA Times veteran, is maybe one of those sad stories where we see what happens when the owner sticks his nose into the news because people stop wanting to read it.
All right. Thank you for speaking to us. I've been talking to Peter Spiegel, who is the new managing editor of The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Very good to be here.
Agriculture makes up a significant part of Arizona's economy, but actions coming from the federal government have some farmers concerned. Andrea McAdow owns Rosebird Farms in Kingman. It's less than an acre and grows baby greens, roots, and flowers. It also serves the area as a food hub, working with other farmers to distribute their products to local customers. But recently, McAdow says, canceled federal grants have caused problems for farmers like her, including from the Resilient Food Systems Infrastructure, or RFSI, and Local Food Purchase Assistance Cooperative Agreement, or LFPA, programs. She spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked how she and her operation have been affected by funding cuts so far.
Yeah, so us personally, we were awarded a RFSI grant, which was supposed to fund infrastructure programs within our state to move food locally, because previously, this is something you might have seen during COVID, is when large-scale infrastructure failed, our small-scale infrastructure had to step in, and it wasn't quite there. So we had a van we were supposed to be awarded about 8 months ago. We've been waiting on that. We were supposed to get our contract in January, and we just haven't gotten any word on what's going to be happening with that. So we're not sure how to plan for our future contracts with wholesale customers, and how we're going to be moving the food for our farmers we work for. The other part that we've been personally affected by was the cancellation of the LFPA purchasing program for food banks. We worked with our local food banks here in Kingman. We worked with about three different food banks that we would deliver to weekly. So they canceled the funding for future years, and that means that we will continue out our contract. They have some funding to pull us into a little bit into 2026, but that is about, you know, 20% of our revenue that we have to figure out where we're going to send our farmers' product to instead.
And are you seeing similar things from some of your counterparts at other farms, both in that part of the state and maybe elsewhere in Arizona?
Yeah, so our aggregation distribution is tied into a larger food system within Arizona with some other cooperatives and farmers down in Phoenix, as well as Flagstaff and Tucson. And I've heard stories directly from other farmers, you know, people who have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of crops in the ground that they're not sure where they're going to be able to send them to in the future here.
So you mentioned the LFPA, which is the Local Food Purchase Assistance Cooperative Agreement Program, that was the one where $21 million was canceled in Arizona. What kind of impact might that have just beyond sort of the folks growing the food, but maybe the people who buy or eat that food?
Yeah, so very specifically, like, there will be less fresh food in the food banks because farmers were being paid to deliver this food to the food banks. So that's first and foremost. But there was also a portion of this that this funding helped create an economy of scale for our small to mid-sized farmers that made their businesses stronger. It allowed them to hire farmers that could do more work across the farm. And it also helped with our local food distribution between co-ops and farmers, so that we were making sure we were sending full trucks, you know, back and forth to farmers, to end users. So so we might see increased prices if we're not able to replace that, because we're going to have to be able to make up the cost of the transportation, and also that overhead costs for the farmers too.
So does that mean that you're going to try to find another way to get that food to the food banks, if not through this program?
Potentially through the food banks. I'm not sure how we would make that work, but I think we are more so thinking finding other institutional buyers, other large-scale buyers, different markets that we haven't reached yet, so different locations. So there's, I think we're trying to put our heads together and seeing how we can sell these products that our farmers are growing.
When you take all of these changes in funding, you know, sort of in total, what does that mean for, you know, the viability of Rosebird Farms going forward? Like, can you continue to operate as you have been? Can you continue to operate at all?
Yeah, so it's more so We will find a way through. I don't expect we'll have to close our doors, but we will have to pivot and potentially not be able to serve, you know, the people who might need it the most, because we have to find different markets in order to keep things going. And there's also the part of, we were planning to make expansion because of these grants we had been awarded, and we're not sure that they're going to happen. So it may just be playing a little bit smaller until we can figure out how to fund these programs that would have allowed us to expand our reach and our service areas.
What kind of impact have you seen from all the talk of tariffs? I know that a lot of folks in the agriculture community were concerned about that. Has that affected you at all?
You know, we haven't seen that specifically. I'm always worried about the fact that, like, it might increase our costs, you know, purchasing things, especially like packaging that might be coming from overseas. I haven't noticed an immediate impact, but, there's been so much we're trying to keep tabs on that's just one that hasn't, you know, risen to the forefront of my mind just yet.
Okay. I mean, have you found yourself sort of paying more attention to the news and less attention to growing conditions and the fields and all? Like, is this sort of a change in how you have to sort of manage your time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much uncertainty. And I've been communicating a lot with our partners, you know, with the awarding agencies in the state. And the people we work with, my farmers, you know, spending hours just trying to reassure them that we're going to be able to figure this out. So it has been very stressful. And yeah, it's just, there's just a whole other set of things to worry about other than just running our business. So,
What have you heard, if anything, from folks, you know, either in D.C. or elsewhere about the possibility of some of this money maybe coming back at some point? Or do you just get the impression that it's kind of gone for good?
We've been pretty much in the dark. We don't really know what's happening up until the point that they canceled LFPA. Like, we were really unsure if it was on the table or not to be cut. So I had reached out to some of our representatives and had been assured that, you know, nothing for farmers was going to be cut whatsoever. And, you know, a month later it was. So it's really, I really don't feel like we have any assurance that, you know, it's going to go either way. So
how does that affect your planning? Like, how do you try to figure out, you know, what you're going to plant and maybe how much of it you're going to plant? And then as you talked about earlier, like, what you're going to do with it when it's time to take it out of the ground.
Yeah. It's very uncertain. Luckily I'm small enough where I can pivot. But some of our bigger farms have, you know, they have to purchase materials way ahead of time. And you know, you're kind of just hoping that it all works out. And I feel like a lot of our farmers are just the attitude too, that like, we'll figure it out when it comes to it, but we do have to make a decision, yes or no, right now. So it's been very uncertain, and trying to plan when you don't know what's going to be coming, you know, the news in the next week. It's stressful.
All right. That is Andrea McAdow, owner of Rosebird Farms in Kingman. Andrea, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. You are listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the magic and physical exertion of using an over 100-year-old letterpress.
I love being able to manipulate the machine with my body instead of just pressing a button. It makes me feel a little bit more connected. It helps me think more clearly.
We will hear from the founder of a small independent press as our Analogs series continues. But first, East Lake Park is one of the few historically Black neighborhoods in Phoenix. In pre-Civil Rights era Phoenix, Black families weren't allowed north of Van Buren Street. They were kept to segregated schools in South Phoenix and redlined into properties in the area. It's where the Black community here gathered during the Civil Rights Movement, and where Martin Luther King Jr. celebrations are still held today. And it's where you can find Phoenix's only brick-and-mortar Black-owned bookstore, Grassroots. The store was founded by Ali Nervis back in 2019 in a hallway of the Afrosoul Marketplace, a Black business incubator and shop. Today, it's a bookstore, juice bar, and co-working space that's full of life. My co-host, Lauren Gilger, went there recently to talk to Nervous more about it and why he started it.
It was two very distinct audiences that I was trying to create this space for. I had been an entrepreneur before, and I had been an organizer. I was an organizer at the time, which is where the name Grassroots came from. And I saw a disconnect between the business community and those who were creating something from nothing with, you know, these incredible ideas and all this talent on creating wealth, and those who were on the front lines, who were organizing, who were, you know, really working and sacrificing so much to make changes and improvements in our society and really look out for the least among us. And I just felt that if those two groups could get together and build relationships, right, it would mean more sustainability for organizations. It would mean more connectedness for business people. And I just saw a lot of benefits to, you know, creating a space like that. And so really that was one of the goals, was to create the space where entrepreneurs and business people could come and work on their ideas, and organizers could come and do the same thing, but also be in community together, right? And then the second one was, selfishly, I have two young daughters who were much younger then, and there was a business that was located on Indian School that we used to always go to. It's a black-owned business, and we would go get smoothies. And that was like one of our favorite pastimes, and they shut down. And we tried to do everything we could to, you know, help them stay around, but they weren't able to make it. So selfishly, I wanted a place for myself and my daughters, but I knew, you know, other parents, other families, you know, would value a space like this, because there's not a lot of spaces in Phoenix where you can come and sit down and read, and your children can see themselves reflected in the pages, and at the same time get some healthy food, smoothies, all natural juices and things like that.
Tell me a little bit about the books on the shelves here. I mean, there are a lot, but I can tell you've got a wide variety of genres, right? Like, there's a whole kid's corner back there, right?
Yes, and it did start that way. So it did not start that way. So that brown shelf that's right on the other side up against the wall, that was the bookshelf that we started with. And it was a Christian bookstore that was closing down. So we went, picked it up, brought it here, and loaded it up. Again, like I said, books from my house, books I was able to find. And they were all really sad, history, social commentary, social justice, like the stuff that I was reading, because again, I was an organizer, the stuff that I was studying. And my wife was like, you know, people don't want to read those sad books.
Too heavy.
Yeah, my wife, she's a fiction reader. Like, she'll read a fiction book in a day. And so she was like, yeah, you got to get some fiction. You got to get some other stuff. You know, it's going to appeal to more people than just people who are like, think like you, or looking to read books that you're looking for. And so now, you know, our fiction section is just as big as our nonfiction, if not bigger. Our children's section is the most popular section in the whole store.
Tell me about the community that's been coming because you created the space for it, right? Like, it's almost as simple as that sometimes, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a beautiful thing, because the things that we wanted to see, the reasons why we created this, is really starting to take root, right? We see people coming to, you know, just sit and work, right? And work on their ideas or have meetings. And it's a beautiful thing, because that's why it's here. It's not here to make, you know, all these profits or make all this revenue or anything like that. It's really here for community.
I want to ask you about this neighborhood, because you're in Eastlake Park, which is one of the few kind of historically black areas of Phoenix. There's not a giant black community here, as you know, I'm sure. What does it mean to you to be here? Was this done on purpose?
It was absolutely done on purpose. I'm not a Phoenix native. I'm a military brat. So I was originally from Alabama and lived in Texas for a while. But just being a student of history, when I moved here, you know, I started to understand the history of Phoenix and the history of Eastlake Park, and I was very inspired by it. And so when this opportunity came about, and it was happened to be in Eastlake Park, I knew it was meant to be. And so for us, you know, it's a great feeling and a great honor to be continuing the legacy of Eastlake Park, where so many black-owned businesses were located, where so much culture was fostered, and so much community was built. And so, you know, we're proud, and that's why we wear the badge proudly, because a lot of people don't know about East Lake Park even still. And so we make it a strong part of our brand to say, you know, we're located in East Lake Park.
What do you see your role in the broader kind of Black community here, which seems to be trying to find its voice in a way? I was just down at the Carver Center talking to the guy who's running that now and all the initiatives he's trying to start and create something real there and really be able to give a voice to this community that's been, you know, kind of a not the big story in Phoenix for a long time. How do you see your role in that?
Really, we just want to be a part of the fabric. There's so many incredible things that are happening in Phoenix right now. Again, I'm not from here, so I wasn't a part of prior efforts, prior initiatives that happened, but from what I've seen from my vantage point now in 2025, I see so much activity, I see so much work, and collaboration as well. And so we're beneficiaries of that. Again, we're a part of AfroSoul Marketplace. So AfroSoul Marketplace led the charge to secure this whole location and, you know, and provided a space for not just us, but so many other businesses to have a home. And so we try to continue that tradition, right? We have businesses, products that we sell here. We have local authors that we highlight. We want to serve and provide a benefit, right? And uplift and encourage those who've been marginalized for a really long time. And so that's the role that we want to play.
Last question for you. What do your daughters think? They like it? They hang out a lot?
They love it. When they're here, they don't read as much as I would like them to do. They try to play their iPads when they're here. But no, it's a great feeling. My oldest, she actually is doing a Black History presentation at her school today. And so she asked for my business card so she could tell all her classmates about the bookstore. So it's a great feeling. Yeah.
Ali, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. For many people, rodeo is a quintessential American sport, or at least a version of America. Rodeo conjures a very specific image: cowboys in the South and the West, on the farm or the prairie or the frontier, riding horses and hurling lassos. But for many others, rodeo is also a place to explore their gender identity, and a source of community for queer people who can't find it anywhere else. And it's that latter story of rodeo that Dr. Nicholas Villanueva tells in his new book, Rainbow Cattle Company. Villanueva is a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, but he is also a rodeo athlete. He joins me now. And Nicholas, for those of us who have only a kind of vague sense of rodeo as a series of horse-related events, tell us what it means to compete as a rodeo athlete.
So rodeo, there are horse events, barrel racing or pole bending, which is zipping around all these different poles, flag racing, where you grab a flag out of a bucket and then you go around the arena and you stab the flag back in this other bucket. So those are the speed events. Then you've got what we call the rough stock events, and that's bull riding, steer riding, steer wrestling, which is also called shoot dogging. And then you have roping events where you're trying to rope an animal.
If you're comfortable saying, when you were a kid and you were getting into horse-related sports and stuff like that, were you out at the time?
No, actually, I always knew
myself.
And my identity. But I actually used rodeo as a way to try and deflect, if you want to say that, homo criticism. And instead, I found that the sport itself deflected my interest or concerns about my identity as a gay man, because it was more about just the sport and having fun.
Right. I mean, you can either rope a horse or you can't rope a horse, right?
Right. I guess I had two rodeo experiences. One, when I was closeted and trying to use rodeo to, you know, strengthen my masculine capital, this masculine identity. And then gay rodeo, you don't have to do that. I mean, we have we have drag performers. So, you know, so there's this lack of concern about having to demonstrate some type of masculinity.
Right, right.
Everything is accepted in the gay rodeo.
I have to imagine that must be extremely affirming to be able to do this extremely challenging physical activity that rodeo already is, and also feel like you can bring your full self and identity to it.
Right. And also, the first official gay rodeo was 1976. The person who founded it, Phil Ragsdale, wanted this to be a safe place for someone to compete and maybe celebrate with their partner, jump up on the rails of the arena and hug and kiss the person who's there to support them,
yeah,
without concerns of any homophobia or backlash or violence.
So as you started to get more into this, in addition to the personal experience that you were having, if I'm not mistaken, you also started to understand the connections between the gay rodeo world and the gay liberation movement more broadly.
Yes. Gay liberation in places you didn't really expect to see it. Many participants in gay rodeo grew up in Christian, conservative, small towns, and they have Christian conservative values. Mm-hmm. I mean, so much so that even politically, they vote most likely Republican.
This is really interesting to me because I think so often in conversations about the gay rights movement, there is this assumption that, as you were alluding to, it was consolidated in these places where, quote unquote, alternative culture was already well established, or that are more associated with underground forms of expression, that sort of thing.
Yes.
But no less relevant, of course, to your point, is that there have always been gay people in places where those outlets don't exist.
Yes. Many of the people that I know in gay rodeo, it was all about rodeo, not being gay. And then finding the Gay Rodeo Association was just more of a social environment, you know, meeting someone
sure.
like you, who had the same interest as you, who grew up with the same values, the same interest.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that it seems like was really important to you to write about in the book, is the way that rodeo became this vessel for gay culture and gay community to reach people who might not otherwise have been able to find it.
Yes, and there's a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 3, it's on the rodeo programs. I went through, 30 years of rodeo programs, 12 programs a year. Some of these programs were 20 to 30 pages in length. There was a lot of research involved, but for a historian, we love the archives. That's what we do.
Right,
and
it's a gold mine.
What I realized and what I argue in that chapter of the book is that this was more of the how-to manual. How to be gay. Where do you go? Everything from bars to the bathhouses. They even had advertisements for magazines like The Advocate, and someone from a rural town may have never heard of that magazine, but then they could subscribe and learn more about LGBTQ plus culture.
Isn't that amazing? You're a gay person at this time. You take the leap to get involved in the gay rodeo, and then it ends up opening these doors to all these other elements of this community that you're a part of that you maybe didn't even know existed.
One of the most interesting parts about my research, the primary source that I used, and it's a little embarrassing to say, gay men's pornographic magazines. That is where you actually had people write true stories about rodeo. If you went to the newspapers in the early 80s, there was always a tongue-in-cheek kind of like make fun of or mock the rodeo. Like, oh, look at this. These gay men actually can ride a horse, you know.
And right. Imagine that. Silly, yeah.
Trivial stuff like that. But then these articles, these pornographic magazines, they actually had the stories. And so when I went to my research librarian, I said, I need you to find these editions of Honcho and Blue Boy and all these different names of Playgirl, all these different magazines. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, really, I am just reading the articles. Yes, this is research. And it really was, because those were the only journalists or authors that were taking gay rodeo serious at the time.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Villanueva, a professor of ethnic studies and critical sports studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, who is also a rodeo athlete in his own right and the author of the book Rainbow Cattle Company, a book which takes gay rodeo very seriously and where you can read about the stories he's been telling today and a whole lot more. Dr. Villanueva, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman, and we close today with the next chapter in our Analogs series about people who make things by hand and what those things tell us about those people.
We figure it's about 80, 90 years old.
Even though the technology is so rudimentary, you can have a lot more control.
It has lately, in the last 15 years, turned into more of a passion type of thing.
I needed an escape.
Angie Dell's letterpress machine stands in the corner of a workshop in downtown Phoenix. The press is about 3.5 feet tall, and it's an elegant combination of levers, cranks, and wheels. The press is flanked by a pair of windows because Angie likes working in sunlight. There's no outlet in this particular corner of the workshop, but that's not a problem because the press doesn't need to be plugged in.
This press is from 1911, so it's over 100 years old, and they just don't make them like they used to. Yeah. So you can...
Yeah, and just looking at it, I mean, it's all like wood and really heavy, I don't know, is that steel or iron?
Iron, yeah. I had to use a forklift to bring it into the space because it cannot be moved. It is super heavy.
To run the letterpress, Angie has to practically climb on board the thing.
These are foot pedals here,
yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yes, this is an operating foot pedal. This is the brake.
Printing this way is a full body process. First, Angie squeezes a spiral pattern of ink onto a large metal plate. Angie's feet, meanwhile, start working the pedals, which makes the wheels start to spin. If you squint, it's almost like Angie's riding a unicycle that doesn't move. As the wheels turn, a pair of rollers start sliding back and forth across the ink spiral, gradually coating the circular plate with a thick layer of ink.
And the ink disc turns a little bit every time the rollers come up and down. As you can see, it actually has a process for moving it. So it's a really beautiful, I love watching the ink get dispersed over the disc because it always creates a different pattern every time.
And you're doing this all with the foot pedal?
Yes. We'll use this large wheel with your hand here just to get a little bit of momentum to get these heavy pieces moving. And then with your foot, it can take a little getting used to for people who are new to it. You start to learn the rhythm of the press and how much pressure it needs in order to keep moving fluidly.
You can probably hear the physical effort in Angie's voice. The sheer amount of energy it takes just to get this letterpress going is intense. And that's all before you print a single word. Angie doesn't mind, though.
I love being able to manipulate the machine with my body instead of just pressing a button. It makes me feel a little bit more connected. It helps me think more clearly, you know, take it out of the realm of the brain into the full body.
Angie uses the letterpress to make books, soup to nuts. Angie writes the words, then prints those words on paper using the letterpress, and then binds the whole thing together.
My way of thinking about writing has completely changed because of my passion for book arts now. And when I started off, I
would always come in with a piece of writing, and I would be like, okay, like, how can I make this into a book? How can that work? And nowadays, I think I'm often thinking more about form and the way that the book can enhance the text.
A long time ago, Angie wanted to be a regular novelist, but not anymore. Bookmaking is a way for Angie to tell more of the story.
It does make me feel more connected to it because I grew up really struggling when I was younger with depression. And I've just found over time, if I am sitting still, if I am looking at a computer, if I'm looking at a screen, that's what gets me sort of like caught up too much in my own head and tunneling into, I think, a heaviness. I think I was writing a lot of kind of dramatic or heavy things as a writer, and I had a harder time figuring out how to be like joyful as a writer. For me, the physical process is what brings me joy. There's something deeply connected with like our sensory body experience that stimulates our brain in a different way. So if I'm going to be spending all day or staying up late at night finishing a project, I would much rather be doing something that makes me feel alive and makes me feel awake than something where I'm just kind of like sinking further and further into my psyche, if that makes any sense.
That makes a lot
of
sense.
It's a nice balance.
Yes. Thank you for sharing. On the day I visited the workshop, Angie had just started working on a new project.
I'm working on a book right now that's it's a small book that's about American obsession with grassy lawns and how I grew up in the Midwest. When I get back and I get to like feel the grass in my hands in Wisconsin, it really, really makes me emotional. So I became interested in being like, okay, so what is that for people? Like, why are we so obsessed with having a lawn? And a lot of it for me came back to smell. I know that a little bit about how our sense of smell works and how it's so closely associated and located in the brain to our emotional receptors and our memory. And so that is why going back to Wisconsin, like I am just walking around like smelling everything because I don't have a good memory. And so it's hard for me to remember childhood unless I'm like experiencing the senses.
As a writer, Angie had always struggled with how to write about smell. So for this project, instead of trying to describe smell, the book itself will be a vessel for smell. In addition to the book, Angie is making an envelope for the book, and the envelope will be scented to smell like a freshly cut lawn.
So that hopefully, you know, at least for those buying a book and then opening it right away, they will be able to receive that scent of grass.
Wow.
It won't last for a long time, I don't think, but I think it'll be a really cool experience.
So you're facing this challenge that many writers have faced, which is not even just how do I write about smell, but how do I write about childhood? You know, how do I write about this feeling? And for most writers, they just have to sit there and wrestle with the words and try to get as close as they can. And you have found your way to this process where through not just the writing of the words, but also the making of the receptacle for the words and putting more of your senses into the process of trying to capture this thing, you can get so much closer to expressing this thing. But you still can't totally get there.
No, can you ever in any medium? I don't know. For me, it's the way that I'm able to access things that are otherwise locked away in my brain. And I do think that it's important that we engage all of our senses just for the sake of our memories, for the sake of happiness in life. And I want to see what could be done with the book in that way.
Yeah, even if you can't get all the way there, why not get as close as you can?
Yeah, I mean, how do we get the rest of the way? I don't know, edible books is something that would be fun to do.
Ooh,
at some point.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.